Deutsche Welle. Inside Europe.
Hello and welcome to Inside Europe. I'm Gabriel Borud in Bonn. On this week's program, we're going to take a look back at reports we've had this year that will hopefully tickle your radio fancy. First, getting the lowdown on Europe in a bar in Ireland.
It is ludicrous what's happening. It is unprecedented what's happening. Bullying and blackmailing the Irish government and the Irish people into assuming a debt that is not theirs.
Also on the program, why London's public servants enjoyed the Olympic Games. A crazy Dutch shipbuilder with a biblical, if not antediluvian, identity crisis. And the Eurovision Song Contest revisited. Honestly, what would a look back be without it? Those stories and more coming up on Inside Europe. Throughout the entire year, headlines around Europe almost without fail concerned the Eurozone debt crisis. Pick your cliché, because by now they've all been used. The crisis has been like a cloud that just wouldn't pass. Now, we here at Inside Europe do apologize for dwelling on the dismal, but we couldn't escape the cloud either. More often than not, our top story was about the financial problems in Europe's indebted states. So you can imagine how hard it was to pick a best-of report. There were literally dozens to choose from. Well, the award goes to Stephen Beard, our trusty correspondent, who nipped into a bar in Ireland for a little shelter from the proverbial storm.
Kennedy's pub in the tiny hamlet of Ballyhea, County Cork.
Hello, a pint there, Ivan, please.
For the past 30 years, it's been a kind of second village hall, but cosier. The ceilings are low, polished wood and brass fittings gleam reassuringly. On the walls, photos of Irish sports teams basking in past victories. But the present isn't so cheery. It's 9 o'clock on a Friday night and there are barely a dozen people here. You might think whatever the crisis is doing, it's not driving the Irish to drink. But landlady Yvonne Kennedy has a different take.
I will be berated for this, but my opinion is that Irish people medicate, celebrate. We do everything with alcohol, and we do it to excess.
She says people are drinking plenty, but at home, where it's cheaper, if not as convivial as here in the bar. Local warehouseman Pat Maloney has seen his income cut in half during the downturn.
Going out, coming to the pub here, it's very seldom we come out anymore.
How often do you come to this pub?
Oh, this pub, I said this is the second time I've been here in 5 years. We just can't afford it.
2 hours later, a few more drinkers have drifted in to Kennedy's. The booze has been flowing copiously. People are starting to unwind.
I'll have a gin and tonic, please. I'll have a gin and tonic, please, and a brandy for the alcoholic over there with the red hair.
But stony-faced and stone-cold sober in the adjoining pool room sits another local and pub regular, Dermot O'Flynn.
It is ludicrous what's happening. It is unprecedented what's happening. Bullying and blackmailing the Irish government and the Irish people into assuming a debt that is not theirs.
He says the European Central Bank failed to stop Ireland's property bubble inflating. Then it pressured the government to bail out all the banks, saddling the taxpayer with huge debts. Dermot organises a regular local protest march. And he says when he goes around the county with his campaign, he sees real anger.
The people who got the hottest reception were the people who stood up and spoke about violence.
Threatened violence.
Threatened violence. It's time for the gun, it's time for the bullet. And I'm telling you, there's that undercurrent here of people who, I think, are ready to just explode.
It's now 11 o'clock and the mood has mellowed. Dermot and others are singing a lament to the centuries of oppression that Ireland has suffered.
Religious of Irish blood, waking to the morning.
Francis O'Brien, a 73-year-old dairy farmer, says Ireland is now run by foreigners, by the Germans and the French. She says Ireland's freedom fighters, who won independence from the British yoke, would be appalled.
Oh, how would they turn in their grave? They gave their lives to give us freedom, and we've handed it.
Handed away your independence and your sovereignty.
Our sovereignty, really, because other people are deciding what's happening in our country now.
The crisis has touched everyone in this pub. Teacher Fiona Fitzpatrick has seen many young friends lose their jobs and then emigrate, and she's fretting about the future.
I am a mother. I'm a mother to three children who I absolutely adore, and I really want my children to have a chance here, and I just feel their future has been stolen away. Having to leave your country because you have to, because you don't have work here, that's not what I want for my children.
Just before Kennedy's closed, at 1 o'clock in the morning, some regulars sang this sad little song about the death of some Irish fishermen in a storm off the coast of Donegal. Dermot O'Flynn says Ireland is also at sea.
This thing is just going from bad to worse. And it is. It is going from bad to worse. And God knows where it's going to end up.
Stephen Beard, Deutsche Welle Radio, at Kennedy's Bar in County Cork, Ireland.
For about 6 weeks this summer, we were given a break from Euro woes when the London Olympics rolled around. News of gold, silver, and bronze took over the headlines, and very positive assessments of how the games went down in London. Indeed, the games were a resounding success, enjoyed by billions of viewers worldwide and millions who came to see them firsthand in the British capital. But it wasn't just the tourists who were able to relish. London public servants were able to work from home for the duration of the Games. Grounds for jubilee in itself, as we heard from Carol Allen in this postcard before the Games got underway.
This is yet another confirmation to those of us who've been dreading the Games that this summer London's going to be a no-go anywhere area where normal life as we know it will grind to a halt. It started when Chelsea won the Champions League final against Munich and local residents were unable to get in or out of the barricaded West London streets as the triumphant team mounted a victory parade. Next up is going to be the Queen's Jubilee weekend when the river will be out of bounds to Londoners without a ticket to stand on one of the bridges and watch the Queen sail by, transport will be groaning under the weight of increased traffic, and business will grind to a halt for the four-day weekend. And hot on the heels of that is the dreaded Olympics, where the indications are that no one will be able to get anywhere, apart from, that is, Olympic athletes and VIP guests, including politicians, who'll be swanning past in their limos in the exclusive car lanes, while we ordinary mortals fume in the traffic jams. We can't say we haven't been warned, though. For months we've been inundated with wartime-style emergency messages to walk or cycle to work rather than take public transport, to avoid using our cars throughout the whole period, and to expect a rush hour which starts at 5:30 in the morning and a 30-minute wait before we can get on a train. So, if you're one of those rare Londoners who actually managed to get a ticket to one of the Olympic events, after all the VIPs and so on had scooped up their generous allocations, of course, it's going to take you all day to get there anyway. It's a bit of a cheat, really. Our city's being taken over for a gigantic party, and those of us who live here are told to stay home, unable to even press our noses up against the Olympic window pane. Some Londoners have made plans to go abroad for the duration, though, let's face it, it's only members of the government and the odd multimillionaire who can take a full 7 weeks' holiday, and it'll probably be hell anyway getting in and out of the country with all those visitors. So it looks like most of us will either suffer 7 weeks of house arrest or spend most of the day struggling to get to work. Even those of us who already work from home actually have to go out quite a lot. Going back to those civil servants, though, who aren't used to the Homer's office environment, here are a few tips from a veteran. It's OK to spend the morning emailing at your computer in your nightwear. Most of us actually do it. But do avoid video conference calls at all costs, obviously. And be wary of social networking. The boss may be checking your Facebook page. And no tweeting about who's doing well in the Olympics. Otherwise, that'll confirm suspicions that you're spending your day in front of the telly instead of looking after the country. If you're not going into the office, you don't have to waste valuable time shaving or putting on makeup, but do have a shower from time to time, otherwise you'll upset the cat. As for me, if I'm going to be on enforced gardening leave, well, the garden's actually in a bit of a state. One thing I won't be doing, though, is watching the games on telly. Did I not mention? I can't stand sport. Carol Allen, Deutsche Welle Radio, London.
Now, apart from Carol, not everyone was able to delight in the Olympic Games. Some weren't even allowed into London to see them. No, this isn't a report on discrimination of any kind or on any Olympic haters like Carol. We're talking about a Dutch carpenter who wasn't allowed to take his boat up the Thames because it was an ark, a full-scale replica of Noah's Ark. This is no joke. After having dreamt of a massive flood that submerged his homeland of the Netherlands, Johan Hubers decided to build Noah's Ark. He didn't make it to London, but he did set off on a world tour. I got a hold of him just before he embarked. What do I hear there in the background?
There's animals here on the boat. They see me and they are just screaming, let me out or give me food or just talking to me.
What kind of animals are we talking about here?
All kinds. We have donkeys, goats, sheep, birds, dogs, cows, monkeys, everything.
Why did you decide to rebuild Noah's Ark?
Everybody complain about God. God do all the wrong things, like hungry in the world, war, etc., etc. So when you buy a new iPhone, you don't know how it works. So you look in the book of the iPhone, and then you know how the iPhone's working. Now, we have also a book for our life. The name of that book, that's the Bible. And in the Bible, it's written what is God willing from us. So what I will tell the people that they have to start to reading the Bible, and then they know what the will is of God.
So you used the Bible to build the ark. How did you figure out how big the ark should be?
Now, it's written in the Bible that he has to make it 300 elbow in the length, 50 elbow in the wide, and 30 elbow in the high. He has to make a door inside between the levels. He has to make it from gopher wood. He has to paint with black tar and all kinds of things. Now, when you read the Bible 700 times at only that part of Noah, then you can find the secret of how strong was the boat. Can he survive the waves? It's all written in the Bible. It's an amazing book. Unbelievable.
Did you build the ark yourself, or did you have help?
The first 3 years, I had only three people who helped me with welding. And after 3 years, we have 14 people to help me to build the wooden construction. And now, after 4 years, tomorrow, 4 years ago, we start. It's unbelievable in a very short time.
Are you afraid that your ark will sink?
No. Why? I have the certificate, because when we welding the construction, we did it with Veritas and Lloyds. And Lloyds is the people who give the certificate when you go on the ocean. So it's necessary that we have a license when we go on sea.
It must have been a very expensive project. Where did you get the money to build the ark?
From the Rabobank. It's a business bank here in Holland. And from my brother-in-law.
Are you using it as a tourist attraction?
Yeah, just for my mission, to tell the people about the Bible. But it's also a tourist attraction. And it's very nice, because when you don't believe in God, you have a lot of questions, and you can ask the people who are working here on the boat. It's a mission, yeah. One thing in our life is sure, that we're going to die. And when we're going to die, we stand before God, and then he will give us the heaven or the hell. And we will tell the people that there is a God who is loving us, and he is willing to help you in circumstances when you have problems or when you don't know God, you can ask him.
Some people go into missionary work when they want to, promote the Christian faith. Not everyone builds a 150-meter-long ark.
Yeah, we live below sea level, near to the coast. I had a dream that the part of Holland was flooded. And then the next day I bought a book of the Ark of Noah. And I said, okay, we're going to build a boat of Ark of Noah. And then we can travel through the channels in Holland and pass all the rivers. And then we can show the people how it looks like the Ark of Noah with all the animals inside. Oh, it's very nice for the children and for everybody. They can feel, they can smell, they can touch. It's an unbelievable experience when you go on the boat.
Can you give us an idea of what kind of animals are on board and how they're protected?
Now, we have a farmer, and he will give them food, and he will give them injections and see if they are ill and if everything is all right. So he is doing the job.
The animals are very happy.
Yeah, they look like, yeah.
And you sound very happy yourself.
All the time, yeah.
Do you see yourself as a modern-day Noah?
Yeah, I feel like the same. But then the real Noah, it was a bigger job for him to do than I. We have tools and we have all kind of machines. So for us, it was only 4 years. And Noah, it took 120 years. It's a very long time.
Johan Huber's there, the Dutchman who rebuilt Noah's Ark.
Noah, oh Noah, lots of rain is on its way. Gonna rain and pour 40 nights, 40 days. Noah, oh Noah, you must hammer all day long. Build an ark of wood, make it big, make it strong.
This is Gabriel Borud in Bonn. You're listening to Inside Europe. This year's Eurovision Song Contest, the 57th of its kind, took place in Baku, the capital of Azerbaijan. Now, this attracted more attention than the contest usually gets, and that's a lot. Human rights organizations used the event to highlight alleged abuses and lack of media freedom in the country. But in the end, Eurovision was more about the music than anything else, and it was Sweden's Lorraine who took home the top prize with Euphoria. Our reporter Dave Goodman gave us an idea who was striking the right chords in Baku before the show got underway.
Eurovision is where politics and pop collide, and this year there'll be one almighty bang. On the shores of the Caspian Sea, far from the heart of Europe, Azerbaijan is preparing the biggest song contest ever. Ukraine come to Baku with a football anthem, but as usual, the contest promises a musical muesli.
Some hip-hop influences, but also like club.
It's a cute, ironic and fresh song.
It's a love ballad.
We can call it new Latin music.
Pop song and aphrodisiac.
$120 million viewers are expected to watch the three live shows from Baku. For the hosts and artists alike, it's a chance in a lifetime. This is the night, this is the night.
I will be a star, lend me to your heart. We're a small island, very limited opportunities, obviously. So this is the biggest stage we have.
Kurt Kalea is representing Malta.
Making it through to the final gets me the opportunity to perform my song again. The viewing is a lot higher. So, I'd like to be into the final because it's a personal investment, but also because Malta hasn't been in the final for a couple of years now.
Eurovision means countries as diverse as Germany and Georgia Iceland and Israel all compete on the same stage. Many dismiss the event as a carnival of kitsch. However, this year's smallest nation, San Marino, is seizing the opportunity for maximum exposure.
You know, there's people who neither know where San Marino is or if it exists. That surprised me.
Alessandro Capiccioni is San Marino's head of delegation.
And I thought, well, this is the right event, the right opportunity for San Marino to be known, especially in the Eastern European countries. It's not dealing only with music, it's something geopolitical in a way. And that's why San Marino is there too.
Hosting Eurovision is also a serious business. Oil-rich Azerbaijan is rumoured to be spending nearly 60 million euros on the event, the biggest sum ever. They've even built a brand new 25,000-seat arena in just 8 months. Critics argue, though, that the cost to local residents is even higher. For human rights campaigners, last year's winning song, Running Scared, has proved ironically prophetic.
You know, we can understand the demolishing and beautification of the city or something else, but the way how it is going on and the way how the government implementing, without any court decision and without proper compensation.
Rasul Jasfarov is from Sing for Democracy, an umbrella group of Azeri human rights organisations. They say people have lost their homes for Eurovision.
There were many cases when the authorities just came and they said that, you know, we need to demolish it and we have an order. Directly for the concert hall, it's about 65 families. It's about more than 200 people.
Freedom of the press is also an issue for campaigners in Azerbaijan.
Now we have 4 journalists in jail. One journalist shot in front of his house in 2005, and one stabbed and killed in November of 2011, and no one brought to justice. It's very hard to act as a journalist, as a human rights defender, and as a, you know, independent person who are thinking differently.
Azeri authorities, though, maintain the event is not political. Kamran Agassi is from host broadcaster Ijtimai Television.
It's a cultural event. Obviously, there are different elements in the society would like to hijack the event to serve their own objective. But at the end of the day, what we're doing a great show, and we will continue to do so. And if people having certain efforts to impose their own agenda, it's not for us to judge them, obviously. We need to deliver a good show for the contestants and to the audience who is going to watch the Eurovision.
Azerbaijan's not the first country to take advantage of the kudos of hosting the biggest musical event in the world. In the last decade, other ex-Soviet winners, Estonia and Ukraine, have also used the contest to promote themselves as modern, democratic European nations. Whilst only one country can carry off the Grand Prix next Saturday night, the Azeri government hopes it will be the true victor in the Eurovision propaganda battle, being waged before the musical contest has even begun. Dave Goodman, Deutsche Welle Radio, Baku. I know this is about to go down
as the big one. And the big one's continuing on and on. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Gabriel Borud in Bonn. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Gabriel Borud in Bonn. Over the next half hour on this retrospective look at 2012, we visit the battle that was the beginning of Napoleon's end. 100 years on, Belfast is profiting from the sinking of the Titanic.
Yes, what happened to Titanic was a disaster, but Titanic itself was a fantastic feat of engineering and fine craftsmanship.
I always say that, you know, she was all right when she left Belfast.
Also on the programme, the return of the Dancing Queen on lunch break in Sweden. And pesky crow or popular robin, what kind of email bird are you? Intrigued? It'll all make sense if you stay tuned to Inside Europe. This year was the 200th anniversary of the Battle of Borodino, the military showdown that was the beginning of the end for Napoleon's invasion of Russia. It's one of the most important events in Russian history and inspired one of Tchaikovsky's most well-known pieces of music, the 1812 Overture, and of course, Tolstoy's War and Peace. Russians to this day are still enamored with the romance and heroism of the Battle of Borodino, and soldiers from Russia, France, and other European nations returned to the battlefield for a dramatic reenactment. And we were also there, thanks to our correspondent, Karen Percy.
The cavalry is ready. The cannons are en route. And the soldiers are psyched to begin. When it gets underway, it is a glorious, if chaotic, celebration of the 200th anniversary of the Battle of Borodino, where Russian troops and Napoleon's Grand Army faced off just 120 kilometres west of Moscow. Oleg Sokolov is the head of the Russian Union of Reenactments, but today he plays the role of Marshal François Lefebvre, one of Napoleon's most senior officers.
When I was very young, I read the book which changed all my life. It was the Three Musketeers of Alexandre Dumas. And I begin to love history of French and the spirit of French chivalry.
Decked out in traditional French costume, his bicorn hat atop his head, he looks every bit the part. What started out as a small event with just Oleg Sokolov and a few friends during Soviet times is now a truly international event. This year, around 3,000 volunteers came from across Russia, France, Poland and Germany, even the United States and Canada. The uniforms and props have been studied and copied in meticulous detail. The staging camps resembled those of the era, with basic sleeping and eating facilities. There were, of course, some modern touches: a helicopter, hordes of TV crews and mobile phones, as is befitting a modern event broadcast across Russia. This day, back in 1812, was in fact a far from glorious day for the Russians, who retreated in defeat to Moscow. Yet today it is celebrated by Russians of all walks of life. Indeed, this battle has become an obsession across this country. In central Moscow, the locals have been coming in large numbers to the Borodino Panorama Museum, which features a dramatic diorama and painting of the battlefield spanning 360 degrees. The museum's director is Vladimir Presnov.
This particular epoch of the 1812 Patriotic War is very popular in Russia. It's a romantic time with dignified aristocrats and officers and beautiful ladies.
Now let us look how the war of Russia against Napoleon started. Those troops in yellow uniforms are Germans.
Tour guide and senior museum researcher Boris Proskurin tells the story of the Russian retreat very matter-of-factly.
Russia hadn't suffered serious setbacks, military setbacks, for many decades, and it was unthinkable that foreign troops should go into the heart of Russia. So people were quite surprised and quite indignant about that.
But by pulling out of Borodino, Russian lives were saved. And when Napoleon reached Moscow, it was burning, forcing him to return to France. The museum's director, Vladimir Presnov, says Russians like to remember what came after the Borodino battle.
This battle dictated the way the rest of the war played out, and as we know from history, it marked the beginning of Napoleon's demise. Just a few years later, the Russian army entered Paris and Napoleon was stripped of the emperor's title. The sun was setting on his time. It was a decisive moment that changed history.
The people also loved the pomp and ceremony of the past, something that was preserved even in the Soviet era through military parades and national days of celebration. And so tens of thousands of them made the pilgrimage to Borodino. Russia's third-term president, Vladimir Putin, was there too, using the occasion to pull the strings of patriotism as he spoke of unity and nationalism. By tapping into this Russian obsession, he might be hoping to prompt a turnaround in his popularity ratings, which have flagged amidst concerns about attacks on democratic freedoms and rising insecurity about how Russia will fare as the European economic crisis plays out. But he might also want to take note of the history books that show how some Russian officers returned from France after this campaign with liberal ideas that challenged the ruling elite. Karen Percy, DW, Borodino, Russia.
Some anniversaries, regardless of the tragedy they recall, can bring about real gain. Take the city of Belfast, for instance. 100 years ago, the Titanic, at the time the world's biggest, fastest shipliner, sank to its doom. Now, the Titanic may have found its watery grave in the middle of the Atlantic, but it was born and built in Belfast. The city is finally coming to terms with the disaster and attempting to capitalize on the Titanic's enduring global appeal. My colleague Joanna Impey told us how in this report from Belfast.
When I remember when I was a boy, all I remember is ships lined up the whole way along the quay on the opposite side of the river. So the amount of change that has taken place here is just unbelievable.
Jim Carlyle's father and grandfather both worked in the Belfast shipyards, and the first ship his grandfather worked on when he started as an apprentice in 1909 was the Titanic. At that time, Belfast had the largest shipyard in the world, but the industry began declining in the 1950s, and little remains of it today. Now, though, in time for the 100th anniversary of the Titanic's famous last journey, Belfast is remarketing itself as a centre for Titanic tourism.
Further on, okay.
The multi-million euro project is less of a museum, more of an interactive visitor attraction, exploring the story of the Titanic and the city in which it was built. Tim Husbands is its chief executive.
One of the reasons for its construction was that it would provide a platform for significant economic growth through increasing the number of tourists, particularly international tourists, coming to the area. We anticipate we'll get 425,000 visitors in our first year, of which 110,000 will come from out of state.
That's all very well, but isn't it just a bit odd that Belfast is so proud of its links to what was one of the most infamous shipping disasters in history? In April 1912, 4 days into its maiden voyage from Southampton to New York, Titanic hit an iceberg and sank in the icy waters of the North Atlantic. Of the 2,200 passengers on board, 1,500 lost their lives.
I think it took many decades for the city to come to terms with that sense of association, of grief, that sense of loss, that sense of embarrassment.
Jim Carlyle says his grandfather was very reluctant to talk about the Titanic when he was growing up.
Although when Dad was with it, all they talked about was ships. But it was mentioned sometimes, but not very much, and never outside the family.
But after decades of silence, it's clear that that sense of shame has now waned.
I think it was only in the mid-1980s when Dr. Ballard found the wreck that we were able to come to terms with it and say, actually, yes, what happened to Titanic was a disaster, but Titanic itself was a fantastic feat of engineering and fine craftsmanship.
I always say that, you know, she was all right when she left Belfast.
Every night in my dreams, I see you, I feel you. That is how I know you. Go on.
Okay, I must apologise here. We couldn't have a story about the Titanic without playing a little bit of Celine Dion. Belfast has benefited enormously from the wave of Titanic enthusiasm which followed the release of James Cameron's movie starring Kate Winslet and Leonardo DiCaprio.
Near, far, wherever you are, I believe that the heart does go on.
Obviously, with Mr. Cameron's movie in the 1990s, it fired the public's imagination. The city grew more confident. The peace process took hold. And come the millennium, we felt that we then had the opportunity to use a standout project of international status to help put us back on the map.
But scratch the surface, and Belfast is still a city struggling to emerge from decades of conflict between Catholics and Protestants, known here as the Troubles. Even today, many people in the more deprived parts of Belfast are sceptical about the Titanic project. Community activist Kate Clark questions whether the nationalist or Catholic neighbourhoods will benefit from the massive investment into Titanic Belfast. The entrance fee costs around €16 for an adult, half that for children.
Titanic, I think it's a good project and all that there, but can people afford who live in these areas to go to it? I mean, the price is in it. It's absolutely disgraceful, you know, for working class people. I mean, if you have a family of three or four and you're paying them sort of prices, I mean, you wouldn't be able to afford it. It's like being on the bottom class when you were in the Titanic, you know, you'd be at the sinking end of it.
It's clear that this project has awakened huge pride in Belfast shipbuilding heritage. But some fear the visitor numbers could drop off after the Titanic anniversary celebrations are over. Maybe what it needs now is a hit by Celine Dion to make sure that that pride does go on and on.
Go on.
Joanna Rimpey, DW, Belfast.
In Sweden this year, lunchtime became a dance party. Each workday, thousands of employees around the country abstained from the cafeteria or local restaurants and instead took their salads or sandwiches to the disco, which, according to the organizers of Lunch Beat, as it's called, makes workers more productive in the afternoon. From Malmö in southern Sweden, Malcolm Brabant sends us this report.
The rotating disco ball casts a river of red light on the faces of Malmö's Lunch Beat set. They're dancing energetically to a continuous stream of 1960s classics. The bopping starts precisely at noon and finishes on the dot of 1 o'clock. Malmö is one of about a dozen Swedish cities where dancing at lunchtime occasionally replaces a sandwich eaten at a desk or a trip to the gym. The organiser, Maria Rice, claims that hitting the dance floor in the middle of the day increases productivity in the afternoon.
Naturally, it's becoming a dancing revolution. In the day, when you have been working a lot, it's good to take a break. And when you come here and you get to dance with other people and you focus on the music, you get new energy. And when you come back to work, you are more creative and more happy and you have this good energy.
Linnea Uppesal, an environmental project officer with Malmö City Council, said she was swept up by the positive energy during this, her first visit to the dance session.
It was really fun. It's really good. It gives you energy for the rest of your workday and everyone's happily dancing in there, so it was fun.
Outside, Linnea began talking to the city's deputy mayor, Larry Pitka-Kangas,
who is considering attending one of the sessions in the near future. He has seen a positive change in his employees' afternoon performances.
Of course, I would like to recommend this for other employers. Mostly, I see that they are happy when they come back, seem more relaxed than usual. So I think it's quite good for them.
Another first-time dancer, Lena Eriksson, was perspiring as she left the dance hall, but she had a broad smile on her face.
It was just kind of spontaneous thing to go here, just to blow off some steam in the middle of the day. It's really fun.
Her friend, Alva Maestad, was also glowing and enthusing about the broad section of people who were hitting the floor.
There's the ones with kids that don't not necessarily have the opportunity to go out during the weekend that comes just for the lunch beat. For me, it's such a good, great thing that you can go out and not be drunk and not just do it for an hour and then go back to your regular life.
Similar dances have been held in Serbia, Finland, Germany, Portugal and Britain. The organisers hope that they can export the message of dance beyond Europe and are aiming at countries as diverse as the United States and India. Malcolm Brabant, DW, Malmö.
And I'm Gabriel Borud in Bonn. Stay tuned to Inside Europe if you want to find out what kind of email bird you are. Ah, birds. Wonderful creatures who, going all the way back to the pterodactyl in the dinosaur era, are truly prehistoric. Yet they can tell us so much about who we are, even in our modern world of instant communication. In fact, they can tell us much more than you may have thought. That's at least according to two Scottish researchers who've used different types of birds to describe the way we use email. Are you one of those people who checks their email nonstop? Well, then you're the compulsive woodpecker. Do you send abusive emails? Then you're the boorish parrot. Do you respond immediately and expect the same of others? Then you're the lightning response hummingbird. These are just three of the 12 types laid out by Judith Ramsey of University of West of Scotland and Karen Renaud of Glasgow University. We've got Karen on the line right now. What type are you?
Oh, I'm a compulsive woodpecker. I can tell you that without even thinking twice. I have a very bad habit of reading email first thing in the morning when I get up. And a number of years ago, I had some software running on my machine that would give me a graph of what I was doing. And I noticed when I looked at the graph that I had been switching between other things and email all day. So it was kind of bouncing forth like a ping pong ball. And I was quite shocked by that. And so I started to do this research with a friend of mine at the University of West of Scotland, Judith Ramsey. And so she and I started to study this data that I was getting because I recorded some other people too. And it just seems that some people are more prone to being a bit compulsive when it comes to their email.
Mm.
Yes.
Normally, when we contact people for interviews, we definitely do it over the phone. But this time, I just had to send an email. Now, in my email, I tried to be as polite as possible.
Uh-huh.
What type of bird would that make me?
You're getting close to being a robin.
And what about the robin?
Well, I've called that the popular robin because he takes the time to not depersonalize people. When he does write emails, it's only when he has to. If he can speak to the people personally, he does that. But when he does write an email, he thinks about who he's sending it to and the effect that the email is going to have on that person.
Now, of course, your colleague, Professor Judith Ramsey, did get back to me. But
yes.
Had she not, she would have been an incommunicado ostrich.
Indeed.
Which would have forced me to send another inquiry, making me the pesky crow.
The pesky crow is more, I would think, in a work environment. I don't know if you have people, if you worked with people like this, where they ask you to do something and then within 2 hours they're asking you again by email whether you've done it. And, you know, that sort of behavior. So that's what I meant by a pesky crow. I'm not sure what you would be if you were. Maybe we need to come up with a nagging bird.
A nagging bird. Well, let me finally get to the question I was trying to ask.
Okay.
Why bird types? What is it specifically that made you include them in your study?
Well, it just seemed we had a person here in the department. He's retired now, but he was a bird aficionado. He knew all the kinds of birds. And we were chatting one day about my email work, and I said, oh, could you help me? You know, I want to do this, match these behaviors to birds. And we had a great time. And it seems like it's really struck a chord with people, because a lot of people can understand, you know, a buck passing cuckoo, because the cuckoo is the bird that lays its egg in another bird's nest. Yeah, so that sort of seemed to fit quite well.
So had your colleague been into spiders, for instance?
I don't know spiders well enough. But it also felt like the kinds of birds I used are very well known in Britain anyway. I'm not sure how well known they are in the rest of the world. And people immediately said, oh, yeah, that kind of makes sense. So
you're convinced that the way we use email does indeed say something about our individual personalities?
It just seemed like it was that we're categorizable, that you could, you know, that people have distinctive ways of using email. Perhaps, you know, some people have distinctive ways of using their mobile phones. Other people have distinctive ways of doing other things, you know, the way they want their kitchens in their house and so on. But it seemed like, you know, that we have particular recognizable behaviors when it came to email. And I can basically name a lot of my colleagues here. Not good or bad, but just distinctive ways of doing things.
Could you draw comparisons from your research between the way people communicate face-to-face and the way they use email?
I didn't try to do that. What really concerns me about email is that people will do things by email that they wouldn't necessarily do to your face. So if somebody doesn't feel like doing a job, they might dump it on you by email, where they wouldn't come into your office and do that to you. They would ask very nicely if they came into your office. And so I think email allows people to behave a little bit badly sometimes.
Indeed. Most of the birds that you used in the study denote rather negative characteristics. We've got boorish, pesky, incommunicado, compulsive, hoarding, camouflaging. Do we all have to change the way we use email?
It's very easy not to be self-aware. In fact, the school I went to had as its motto, know thyself. And I've often thought about that motto now that I'm an adult and long out of school. And it's just about, you know, thinking before you send an email, is this the best way of communicating? And if it is the best way, can I do it in as nice a way as possible so the person who receives it doesn't get upset? Because people think that email is free, but it's not free for the recipient. You know, that person has to open it, they have to process it, it takes their time, and time is not free.
So think before you click, you
think
would say.
Think before, exactly. Yes, I actually published a paper called that, exactly that, a few years ago.
Karen Renaud speaking there from Glasgow on the burden of email.
Rise up this morning, smile with the rising sun. Three little birds, it's by my doorstep, singing sweet songs of melodies pure.
Oh, Bob. Now, do you often worry about which fork to use, what the appropriate dress for a dinner party is, or how to make polite conversation? Do you think your social skills are not quite, shall we say, finished? Well, one venerable institution in Switzerland has the answer, and Imogen Folks was on her best behavior to find out more.
So this is a good party trick. It's good exercise for your hands as well.
In a villa high above Lake Geneva, a dozen girls are concentrating hard on this morning's lesson.
Cut. And then you go around and you make little petals. Still while you're making nice conversation.
Learning how to eat an orange with a knife and fork. Ideally, making no sound whatsoever.
I'm just an old-fashioned girl with an old-fashioned mind.
I'm Jessica, I'm 22. I'm from London. I've always wanted to come to finishing school.
I am Sonam. I am from India. I'm going to be very successful. And I'm here because I want to educate myself on cultural differences.
I'm Vivian Neri, and I'm the principal of a finishing school in Switzerland. And it's probably the last finishing school in Europe.
Old-fashioned fence and an old-fashioned millionaire.
We have never been the type of school where girls come walking downstairs with books on their head and go skiing in the winter and learn a bit of typing and things like that.
So what does one learn at 21st century finishing school?
Oh, we teach mainly international etiquette, what we call hostessing, which is really the French art de recevoir, which implies how to be a good hostess, table service, table decoration, floral art, home management, cooking, and so on. But the focus is on international etiquette and protocol.
School principal Vivienne Neary insists these skills are more important than ever, now that the world is so international. And her school is thriving. Girls from all over the world, it seems, still want to know what not to say at a formal dinner.
Religion, politics, sex, perhaps. Money makes most people feel uncomfortable.
Or how to eat cheese correctly, a skill etiquette teacher Rosemary McCallum is happy to share.
Hard cheese is eaten with knife and fork, or with just a fork alone if you're in France. And it's not put on bread, so you don't take a big chunk of cheese and make a sandwich with it. Soft cheese is like butter, so you would break off a piece of bread and then you'd put your cheese, soft cheese, on top of that. The one soft cheese that you shouldn't eat on your bread is mozzarella, that you'd eat with your knife and fork. But otherwise, it's pretty simple.
Simple, well, maybe, but not cheap. Each six-week course costs over $20,000. Still, Sonam from India, too, believes finishing school is a good investment in her future.
Etiquette and table manners, which are the soft skills that are important. Everyone has a degree these days, but to have that extra knowledge is helpful, I think.
So when you're downstairs learning how to eat an orange with a knife and fork, what are you thinking?
It's hard work initially, but you get used to it.
Like the old-fashioned flowers, violets are for me. Have them made in diamonds by the man at Tiffany.
But does an institution like a traditional finishing school really have a future? As Vivienne Neary bids goodbye to her latest batch of girls, she is already making plans.
Well, we probably will open up to men also, because the men used to learn this in officers' school. We have been asked by many men, why don't we give these courses for them also? And I think, yes, we will probably do so in the near future.
So perhaps as soon as next year, Switzerland's last traditional finishing school will take the radical step of becoming co-educational. Oranges, beware.
And an old-fashioned millionaire.
Imogen Folks, DW, Lake Geneva, Switzerland.
DW, Deutsche Welle.
I promise in this new year to be on my best behavior, even if I know I'll never, ever attain the distinction of being finished. But I'll tell you what is finished, this show and another year of Inside Europe. That makes it 35 years and counting, given a few name changes along the way. But can you believe that? We hope you like this week's program and continue to like it for years to come. We had help from sound engineer Marianne Colina and, of course, from our producer Helen Saini. If you have any feedback, feel more than free to drop us a line. Our email address is europe@dw.de. We always love to hear from you. For me, Gabriel Borud, and the rest of the team, goodbye and a happy new year. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn, Germany.